Memorial Day is a time for remembering those who have died. It is inevitable that our mind turns to those who have passed, those final moments we shared, the meaning of their lives, and the heartbreak when we have that epiphany that we will no longer be able to reach out, to call, to see our people in body again. What a stark and difficult reality. The grief of death, if we have really lived, is a burden that we carry with us each and every day. Communities around the world have created times such as we are encouraged to move into our grief, such as All Souls Day, also known as Dia de los Muertos in Latin America. Memorial Day is a little bit different because it was originated as a Declaration Day, or as I should say, Decoration Day, after the American Civil War in 1868, when the Grand Army of the Republic, an organization of Union veterans founded in Decatur, Illinois, established it as a time for the nation to decorate the graves of the war dead with flowers. Over the years, this day of remembrance has evolved, and it has become a time when we decorate the graves of all of our dead. This weekend, as I prepared this sermon, there were some unknown person or people placing flags on the graves of my parents for their service in the Navy, as well as their service as deputy sheriffs. When I visit the cemetery at the end of June, it will be bespeckled with such honors and new plantings as a way to acknowledge the ones that have dedicated some part of their lives, and in some cases, given their lives for our safety. This morning, however, instead of thinking about decorating our beloved's final resting place, I'd like to take the liberty of going somewhere else entirely different on Memorial Day. Instead of grieving on this day, I'd like to think about something different. Someplace that I'm not sure actually exists, but that I often think about when I think about my parents or my Aunt Teresa who died this year. I think about heaven. What is heaven? Do we, can we really believe in such a construct? Does it exist? What might it be like? Pearly gates, golf courses where every drive is a hole in one, bliss. What potentialities might a place like heaven hold, and does it hold it for us, Unitarian Universalists? To understand, we must begin with our own theology. Notable Universalists never debated universal salvation. If God is truly a loving God, then heaven would be available to all of us, regardless of our human foibles. Universalists gave hope, not hell. This was the good news of our religion. We did not have to face hell, but there was quite a debate with Universalists in general about the existence of purgatory. The Roman Catholic tradition of purgatory is that of a transitional condition and has a history that dates back even before Jesus to the worldwide practice of caring for the dead and praying for them, and to the belief found in also in Judaism that prayer for the dead contributed to their afterlife purification. The same practice appears in other traditions, such as the medieval Chinese Buddhist practice of making offerings on behalf of the dead, who are said to suffer numerous trials. Praying for the dead is a practice that presupposes that those who have died are assisted by intercessory prayers with their entry into their final abode, vis-a-vis heaven or hell. What happens after we die? And is there a way to be certain? And do we really need to be certain in order to find comfort in such beliefs? Personally, I do not believe in purgatory. But I do think that after we die, we may face a life review of sorts. Kind of like in the 1991 movie, Defending Your Lives, by actor-director Albert Brooks. Have any of you seen that movie, Defending Your Lives? You've got to see it. It's a little dated, but you've got to see it. The leading character is David Miller, who unexpectedly dies in a car crash, like, boom, hit by a bus, and then is immediately transported to a place called Judgment City, a place where you can eat whatever you want without any caloric consequences. And he does. Daniel is defended by an attorney who will represent him, and they go to court, where it will be decided if he goes back to earth, born again, and works out his issues with regard to fear, or if he is allowed to move on to the next destination, which there's no certainty of. As part of his orientation with his attorney, Daniel learns that earthlings only use 3% of our brains. We are referred to as the little brains, lovingly. His attorney, Bob Diamond, explains that being from Earth as you are and using as little of your brain as you do, your life has pretty much been devoted to dealing with fear. Daniel Miller goes, "It has?" Bob Diamond, "Well, everybody on Earth deals with fear. That's what little brains do. Fear is like a giant fog. It sits on your brain and blocks everything. Real feelings, true happiness, real joy. They can't get through that fog, but you lift it up and, buddy, you're in for the ride of your life." Daniel Miller, "God, my 3% is swimming." This life review helps us to reflect and learn the lessons that were most important for us to understand in this lifetime. Having lost the nearest and dearest to me, I wonder about what they might have faced, if anything, and if it gives me comfort to think that my loved ones are in a better place. Is that such a bad thing? Am I alone in this belief? Am I a naive or childlike because I am willing to believe in heaven? A Gallup poll shares that 81% of Americans currently say they believe in heaven. 10% unsure. 8% do not believe. Clearly, I'm not alone. And for me, that's kind of reassuring. In a Huffington Post article, UU minister Marilyn Sewell wrote about Unitarian Universalist theology and explained that we are of this world, not of the next. Jesus, in fact, taught that the realm of God is within, and contrary to most Christian practice, his teachings were centered on relationship, not salvation. Unitarian Universalists do not emphasize an afterlife. For one reason, we simply don't know anything about it. No one as yet has come back to report. But we do know about suffering and injustice on this earth, and so we try to create the kingdom of heaven here and now with real people. I agree with Reverend Sewell, by the way, about the importance of remaining rational about what we know and remaining grounded in this world. However, I do not want to dismiss the potentiality of heaven out of hand. During last week's sermon, I asked the question, what does it hurt to have a sense of faith based on our core values? In this same line, what does it hurt for a concept such as heaven if it gives us a sense of peace about our death and our loved ones who have passed on before us? What does it cost us? We cannot possibly know. We have no shred of proof that there is heaven. In walks Dr. Eben Alexander, a neurosurgeon who in 2008 contracted a rare form of bacterial meningitis that, according to his account, shut down his neocortex, the seat of human consciousness. The near-death odyssey that followed was, he writes, perhaps one of the most convincing such cases in modern history. At the end of it, he could declare, "I didn't just believe in God, I knew God." When he fell ill, he was a brain surgeon, but he has given that up to pursue something more worthy of his talents, namely to break the back of the last efforts of reductive science to tell the world that the material realm is all that there is. Alexander explains in his memoir, Proof of Heaven, "My experience showed me that the death of the body and the brain are not the end of consciousness, that human experience continues beyond the grave. More important, it continues under the gaze of a God who loves and cares about each one of us and about where the universe itself and all the beings within it are ultimately going." Harvard graduate, Mass General neurosurgeon, Dr. Eben Alexander. Do we reject Eben's experience out of hand? Before Dr. Alexander's illness, people who had near-death experiences were considered to be deluded. Their brains were shooting off some extra energy in their final moments. Eben approached his experience with a discerning eye of a man of science and medicine, and he shares the certainty of his understanding. He is not the only one, however. Others have had near-death experiences, such as the world-renowned psychiatrist Carl Jung, who in hospital in Switzerland in 1944 had a heart attack and then a resulting near-death experience. His vivid encounter with a life, plus the intensely meaningful insights, led him to conclude that his experience came from something real and eternal. Jung's experience is unique in that he saw the Earth from a vantage point of about 1,000 miles above it. His incredible accurate view of the Earth from outer space was described about 2 decades before astronauts in space first described it. Subsequently, as he reflected on life after death, Jung recalled the meditating Hindu from his near-death experience and read it as a parable of the archetypal higher self, the God image within. People who have had such experiences, and the scientists who are trying to understand this phenomenon, have created an organization and a repository for near-death stories. There is a whole cadre of scientists who are actually endeavoring to prove this exists scientifically without a shadow of doubt, the legitimacy of people's near-death experiences. One such story is substantiated by Dr. Michael Sabam, who is a cardiologist with a book that he wrote entitled Light and Death. It includes a detailed medical and scientific analysis of an amazing near-death experience of a woman named Pam Reynolds, who underwent a rare operation to remove a giant aneurysm in her brain that threatened her life. The size and location of the aneurysm, however, precluded its safe removal using the standard neurosurgical techniques. She was referred to a doctor who had pioneered a daring surgical procedure known as hypothermic cardiac arrest. Scares the heck out of me. It allows Pam's aneurysm to be excised with a reasonable chance of success. This operation, nicknamed Standstill by the doctors who perform it, require that Pam's body temperature be lowered to 60 degrees, her heartbeat and breathing stopped, her brain waves flattened, and the blood drained from her head. In everyday terms, she was put to death. After removing the aneurysm, she was restored to life. During the time that Pam was in Standstill, she experienced a near-death experience. Her remarkably detailed out-of-body observations during her surgery were later verified to be true. Her case is considered to be one of the strongest cases and evidence in NDE research because of her ability to describe the unique surgical instruments, the surgical procedures used on her, and her ability to describe in detail those events while she was clinically brain dead. So she was literally out of her body watching the surgery. In sharing her experience, Pamela shared, "At some point very early, I became aware of my grandmother calling me, but I didn't hear her call me with my ears. It was clearer hearing than with ears. My feeling was that she wanted me to come to her, so I continued with no fear down this shaft." She explained that it was like being pulled out of her body. "It's a dark shaft I went through, and at the very end, there was this very little pinpoint of light that kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The light was incredibly bright, like sitting in the middle of a light bulb. It was so bright that I put my hands in front of my face, fully expecting to see them, and I could not. But I knew they were there, not from a sense of touch. I noticed that as I began to discern different figures in the light, and they were all covered with light, they were light, and had light permeating all around them, they began to form shapes I could recognize and understand. I could see that one of them was my grandmother. Everyone I saw, looking back on it, fit perfectly into my understanding of what that person looked like at their best during their lives. They were specifically taking care of me, looking after me. They would not permit me to go any further. It was communicated to me, that's the best way I know how to say it, because they didn't speak like I'm speaking, that if I went all the way into the light, something would happen to me physically. They would be unable to put this me back into the body me, like I had gone too far and they couldn't reconnect. So they wouldn't let me go anywhere or do anything. I wanted to go into the light, but I also wanted to come back. I had children to be reared. Coming back to her body, she explained, was like jumping into a swimming pool. And she said she was like hanging on the edge, and she wanted to jump, and her uncle had come with her down this shaft and said, "Jump, jump, just jump. It's like jumping in a swimming pool." She's like nervous, so he just gave her a shove. That was pretty funny. Into the light. What does it mean? Is it heaven? Is the light just a gateway to something beyond? I like to think of heaven as a place where we can manifest what we need in order to come to terms with what we learned in this life. A place that is all about love, a place where the essence of my people exist and dwell in peace. Like Pam, in death, we can experience that our loved ones are there supporting and loving us. Some scientists would have us believe that this is residual, just brain stuff, and not real. I mean, what is real aside from the energy that we exchange? I think of life after our birth as utero for the soul. Think about that. I think of life as utero for the soul. This life is a time that we face fear. We learn about transformative power of love. Death, there is no debate on that. But what if instead of being an end, death instead is just another stage in our evolution? This understanding is held and shared in mythology, legend, and literature. My favorite, The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, contains a conversation between Pippin and Gandalf about death. Pippin says, "I didn't think it would end this way." Gandalf explains, "End? No, the journey doesn't end here. Death is just another path, one that we all must take. The gray rain curtain of this world rolls back and all turns to silver glass, and then you see it." Pippin, "What, Gandalf? See what?" Gandalf, "White shores and beyond, a far green country under a swift sunrise." Pippin, "Well, that isn't so bad." Gandalf, "No, no, it isn't." What comfort would we gain by allowing a belief about the condition of life after death to reside within us? Maybe fear would take a far less prominent place in our living if we believed there was something else. Friends, I invite us not to be constrained by our little brains that are fear-based or by our cynical and at times negative culture. Let's dare to allow our imaginations to wander, to soar, fearless. It is true that no one knows for sure about what comes after this life, what resides in death, be it heaven or not. But what comfort is there in believing that there is nothing? Nothing does not ease our grief and our losses. Nothing does not stave away our fear of the unknown. Studies and people who have been on the other side tell us otherwise. Those of us who wonder can look around and see that we are not alone. 81% of us believes that there is something else. Maybe this sense that there is something else is what sticks with us. I'm not saying that we have to buy any theology hook, line, and sinker, like there's this heaven that's in the clouds and St. Peter's at the gate and. Don't have to go there. But if some beliefs give us hope instead of hell, and if at one point those constructs are part of our Unitarian Universalist theology of love, maybe it's worth the time to take another look. What do we have to lose? I invite you to join me after this to have an afterthought session today on this topic. I'd love to hear what you think about this and what you may believe in your heart of hearts that exists after life. I think it would be an amazing conversation. As we explore with anthropological interest these different premises, the one truth we must always keep in mind, the one truth that we must always keep in mind, is that we do not have to think alike to love alike. So you may believe there's no heaven, you may believe that there is, but the truth at the end of the day is love is the most important thing we can give one another. Let us take a time in silent reflection and meditation. For this we pray. May it be so. Amen.